Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star, brave and faithful and true, and cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have...
Sean Aker with us. He is the author of The Happiness Advantage, The Seven Principles of Positive Psychology That Fuel Success and Performance at Work. And as a matter of fact, he is the one of the world's leading experts on human potential, having researched and lectured in 42 countries, working to bridge the gap between the science, listen to the word, the science of happiness and performance in our everyday lives. Trained by some of the best pioneers in the field of positive psychology, he served as the head, the teaching fellow to help teach and design the famed happiness course, the most popular at Harvard at the time. He now serves as the founder and CEO of Aspirin, a research and consulting firm that uses positive psychology to enhance individual achievement and culture and more productive workplace. And let us say, Sean, hi, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Sean, there is a word that you said, the S word, the word science, the science of happiness, which leads us to believe, Sean, happiness doesn't just happen. There is a structure behind it. There's a dynamic that occurs that will cause this thing we call happiness.
Absolutely. The reason we use science is that everyone talks about happiness. They talk about it as authors and self-help gurus, and we get good advice from our grandparents, and we hear it from our companies, and everyone seems to be seeking it. What I was interested in is that, can we study something like happiness? We study things like depression disorder all the time. So what I've done is I've joined a field called positive psychology, which is a movement in psychology which changes the way that we look at humans. Instead of looking at only what causes depression and disorder, what we got interested in is, can you study things like compassion or optimism or hope? And it turns out you can. Not only can you study it, we've actually discovered ways in which you can increase levels of happiness and be able to spread that to people around you as well.
So when we're talking about happiness being a science, there are steps that you take to, I mean, I have to use the word create, to create this happiness within you. I know that if you laugh, the brain releases endorphins, makes you feel good. So if you hear something that you enjoy hearing that'll do something good for you, or you want to share with somebody, it's a chemical release. And based on that chemical release, it's going to cause you to feel a certain way. So if we know depression does it this way, are we talking a reverse effect with happiness?
We are. It's amazing. You mentioned smiling. We found out that if someone just begins to smile, even in the midst of a stressful situation, their brain releases a chemical called dopamine. And that chemical not only raises your levels of feeling happier, more enjoyment in the moment, but the interesting part, the part that I focus my scientific research on, is what happens to the brain once it's positive. And it turns out once your brain is happier, all these extraordinary things start happening to the brain. Your intelligence rises, you become more creative, you have greater levels of energy, and you actually activate other people's brains to become positive as well. So what we found in terms of the science of happiness is basically that happiness is a choice. Your brain has only a limited amount of resources for experiencing the world. As you're listening to this, as you're looking around the world, as you're at work, as you're with your family, your brain only has a limited amount of brain resources necessary to process that, which means your brain gets an unconscious or a conscious choice about how to view the world. And if you're scanning the world for all the negative things, the hassles, the complaints, the stresses, the problems first, your brain doesn't have any resources left over for seeing the things you're grateful for, finding meaning in your work, and finding better ways of creating a better reality. So what we're getting people to do is to realize that if you can take certain steps in your life, not only will you be able to make a better choice with your brain's resources, but it turns out we can actually improve every single business outcome for an employee and actually raise every single educational outcome for children merely by making their brains more positive.
Okay, so what we're really saying that happiness is intentional. If I have the steps, if I know exactly what to do, and let's say I'm in a depressive mood, if I smile, if I do something, if I cause some kind of action, I'm becoming intentional. And being intentional, I control the outcome of my emotions.
You're absolutely right. I think most people think happiness is something that just happens to you. And what we found is that happiness is actually a work ethic. You exercise your body, and the more you exercise it, the better it starts to work and function for you. The same thing is true with happiness. Happiness is actually something we need to consciously pursue and to practice in our lives. And in doing so, our brain gets better and better, not only being more positive, but seeing more possibilities in our reality. So one of the things that we talk about in The Happiness Advantage, the book that I wrote on these seven principles, is we go through seven different ways that individuals can actually change the way that their brain views the world and raise their levels of happiness. For the easiest level, that's just taking on new positive habits. What we found is if you wake up every morning and just write down three new things you're grateful for every day for 21 days in a row, 21 days later, not only is your brain significantly more optimistic when we research it, but what we find is even 6 months later, your brain is not only working faster and better, you're more optimistic, you're finding more happiness in your life, you're feeling less stress at work. So something as simple as writing down three things you're grateful for can actually transform the brain. We can actually watch the brain work differently on brain scans. So that's why we encourage people to, for example, every day journal for 2 minutes about a positive experience they had over the past 24 hours, or do things like meditation or exercise, or my favorite, one of the ones we're researching right now at Adobe, is we're getting their senior managers to write a two-sentence email each morning when they open their inbox. And that two-sentence email, it's an email of praise or thanksgiving that they do for somebody in their social support network. And what that means is that they're writing basically a kind email for 2 minutes a day. What that does is it transforms the rest of their day. Their brain now starts to see more people that they want to praise and encourage. They find more meaning in their work. They actually find deeper connections with the people around them. And after a period of 21 days, not only are they happier, but their entire teams are flourishing.
Okay, let's put this in a different way. The brain was designed to protect us. So we're always looking for something to make sure that we don't get hurt, that's in somehow, way, shape, or form that we're not threatened. So, and stop me if I'm wrong, I'm not a clinician, but from what I'm hearing, what you just said was that if you start doing something nice for yourself, for someone else, showing gratitude, you're starting to, quote unquote, retrain the brain. So instead of it looking to defense and protect you, it's looking to make you feel better because that's the job that it's left with.
Oh, you're absolutely right. Our brain, if left to default, oftentimes will just scan the world for the negative, right? The most primitive part of our brain, around which the rest of it's formed, looks for threats first. And as a result, your brain responds with a fight or flight response. That's what we normally think about with stress. But
sure.
If you train your brain to become more positive, what researchers have found, including a woman named Barbara Fredrickson, a researcher who studies positive emotions, what she found is that when your brain is positive, instead of fight or flight, your brain starts to do something totally different. What it does is it starts to broaden and build. What that means is you broaden the amount of possibilities you see around you, and you build new neural networks, which means that your brain is adapting and learning new things about how to become even more successful in the world around you. So what we're talking about is training your brain to not look for threat first, which, you know, we oftentimes see in the media. You know, most of what I get coming out of a lot of the newspapers or the news organizations is oftentimes about murder and corruption and diseases and natural disasters. And what happens oftentimes is people's brain get trained into thinking that there's a lot more negative things going on than positive things. What we're getting people to do is to recognize that there's other parts of reality that we've been missing out on. And by focusing on the positive, it makes your brain even better at dealing with the parts of the world that we need to fix.
Okay. At StressCore, we're talking about death, damage, destruction. Those are the things that actually sell. If it bleeds, it leads. So we get bombarded with this. So what you're saying is, quote unquote, don't take a knife to a gunfight, fight fire with fire. If they're teaching our brains to react in a certain way, they know what to do to trigger the chemical reaction of the brain to cause a particular behavior. So what you're saying is recognize that's what it is and train it to do the other.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I heard this fantastic story, and I haven't been able to confirm it yet, but even if it's not true, it's a great idea, and it's something I've tried to incorporate into my own life. Is I heard that Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who led the Reconciliation Project, that he, when he wakes up in the morning, he puts out all the newspapers on his desks in all these different languages, and he sees it not as something that's depressing, but he's trained his brain to view it as a to-do list. Like, here are the things I want to be thinking about. Here are the people I want to be sending some donations to. I know some people that I could send to go help out in Haiti or Japan. So instead of seeing it as something debilitating, he's trained his brain to see it as something that allows him to find out how he can actually actively create a better world. And I think that's what we want to be doing. Otherwise, we're creating, and you were describing it, what we create by seeing all that negativity is something we call the medical school syndrome, which is if you hear a list of all the symptoms and diseases when you first start medical training as a first-year medical student, many of those brilliant and aspiring doctors suddenly think that they have all of the symptoms and diseases that they're reading about, and their bodies start to actually manifest that. The same thing is happening to us as a society. The more we hear about the negative, the more our brains actually change, and we respond to the world as if that's the correct ratio. What we need to be able to do is not only to be able to surround ourselves with positive people, but to actively, as you were saying, fight fire with fire, train our brains to become more resilient and positive. And as a result of that, what we find is there's a ripple effect that occurs. Not only are you changing your own brain, but because of these small parts of your brain called mirror neurons that light up in response to what you see other people, mirror neurons are fantastic, by the way. If I start to smile and you start to smile, the reason is your brain is lighting up as if you're smiling or showing activation. Or if you see lots of people yawn in a room, that's because their mirror neurons in their brains are telling them that they're yawning as well. This is the reason why positivity and negativity spread throughout people. And it's why even if you're an optimistic person, you can pick up on negativity and stress like secondhand smoke. And so what we're trying to get people to do is realize they can make change.
Yeah. Let me put this in a little different format to make it very understandable. When you talk about the mirror neurons, those empathic neurons, what causes us to vicariously live what we see or we're hearing or we're reading about at the time. Every one of us have gone to a movie. You go to a movie, you're watching a large screen, you're sitting around a bunch of strangers, you paid a couple of bucks to get in, you're crying your eyes out. You've got trained and skilled actors and actresses on that screen. And part of that learned skill is knowing what they do and what they say will cause a specific effect. They're intentional. You're going to see something on that screen. Maybe somebody died. Maybe there was a relationship that broke up. Somebody lost a pet. Now, all of a sudden, you're sitting there for no reason at all, and you're crying your eyes out. It's those empathic, those mirror neurons that you're talking about that cause us to vicariously live what it is we're seeing, and there's a transference, and most people don't know how to cut it off. You're sitting in front of the television for no reason at all. You're crying your eyes out. Why? Is it you or is it what's going on the TV that has nothing to do with you?
You're right. You see it with sporting events where somebody will get hit really hard on a football field and everyone will groan or grab the arm or the head or the shoulder that just got hit really hard. What's happening is your mirror neurons are activating you, telling you you've experienced this as well. What it's done, there are parts of your brain that hardwire us not just for sympathy, we're hardwired for empathy, which means that we actually experience what other people are experiencing. But here's the thing I find most fascinating about it around the topic of happiness, which is, of course, we want to buffer our brains against the negative people around us so we don't pick up on that negativity. But if we just buffer our brains, we just end up at neutral. We end up with resiliency. What I research is what's on the positive side of the curve. And given the fact that we're all wirelessly linked at the brain level through these mirror neurons, that means if you decide to make one positive change to your life, like you pick up doing these habits, like writing down three things you're grateful for or journaling each day, that those things, even done in secret, actually end up affecting other people's brains because it ripples out. So what we're getting people to do is to become positive contagions.
Okay, so in essence, if I see you doing it, it's going to cause me to do it. And not with conscious thought. And I really, you had mentioned that, you touched on that for a moment. It's beyond the conscious thought. Your conscious mind, you've got your reason, your logic, your willpower, decision-making. You see something, it's fine. But when it goes beyond that conscious mind, when it goes into that unconscious mind that can't distinguish between fact or fantasy, excuse me, you're living it and you're taking it on as a goal to achieve. If you have a base knowledge of that's what happens, it can all stop.
You're right. I think awareness is actually the very first step. Once you have that awareness, you can start to change your mindset and start to change your behaviors. So part of what we hope for in this research and hope for in this conversation is to let people be aware that happiness is actually a choice, that they can make a conscious decision about how they view reality. And then the flip side of it is the whole point of my book is that if you get your brain to become more positive first, then success rates rise. I think most of us intuitively and unconsciously think we use a formula that's broken, which is if I work harder, I'll be more successful. And then once I'm successful, then I'll be happier. But what we find is that formula doesn't work, that successful people are not always happy. And the reason is every time your brain has a success, it just changes the goalpost of what success looks like unconsciously. So even if you hit your sales target or get into a good school or get a promotion, your brain's going to change what success looks like. But the real important part of it is the formula works backwards, which is that if you can consciously choose to do these habits and mindsets to be positive in the present, then your success rates rise because then your brain is doing what you were mentioning called broadening and building, which it actually becomes faster, more intelligent, more efficient at dealing with the world.
I think a great example of this is, remember, was a few years ago, The Secret came out, and it was talking about drawing all these things to you. Well, one of the major reasons I believe in The Secret, quote-unquote, is not that I was a follower, but it made sense, because if you're saying what you mirror what you recognize and you draw to you what you want, and if you want pain, guess what? That's what you're going to get. And it's a complete turnaround by flipping a few switches is really what we're saying, triggering the right chemicals. If get your dopamine rush, if you know exactly what it's going to take to do that, to change that emotion that's causing you the problem. And that's really what it is. The secret, the science of drawing to you, whether it's, wealth, you can also draw poverty. So realistically, everything that you're saying is the trigger mechanism to cause all of these things.
You're right. In fact, one of the groups I work with is people who are finding themselves unemployed in the current job market. And of course, we don't want to find ourselves unemployed. So it's not a position that we necessarily want. But what we find is that people get down on themselves or they're negative while they're unemployed. They're less likely to actually go out and seek a job. They're less likely to in an interview, actually convince somebody to hire them, because people want to hire people who are positive. And we see people who are positive as more trustworthy, more attractive. We perceive their skill sets as higher. So that the more negative that they become and think, well, once I have a job, I'll be happier, it actually decreases their likelihood of getting that job. But if they flip it around, if they think to themselves, I'm going to do things in the present moment to make myself more optimistic, and I'm going to do these personal positive habits to raise up my levels of happiness, then we find that they're significantly more successful at finding a job. So I think that the formula flows the opposite direction. If you can raise your brain's level of positivity first, then success rates actually rise. And I think the crucial part of that is that intelligence and technical skills, which is what we spend all our time in school focusing upon, that only predicts 25% of your job successes over the course of your life, and only predicts a third of your grades. The two-thirds of a student's grades and 75% of our job successes isn't about the intelligence and technical skills. It's about using your brain positively. It's about three factors. It's your optimism, the social support that you create around you, and seeing stress as a challenge instead of a threat. And if you can impact one of those three things, your success rates rise.
Wonderful. Sean, we're just about out of time, and I want to thank you so much, really, for being with us. Do you have a website we can find you at and get the book?
Sure. The website is happinessadvantage.com, and the book is called The Happiness Advantage, and it's available on Amazon and everywhere.
Hey, Sean, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
Just the only names to you and me. I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. So many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Got it. Dr. Shivali Tasbury with us. She's a PhD, received her doctorate in clinical psychology from Columbia University. That's in New York. She was exposed to Eastern philosophy at a very early age and integrates its teaching with Western psychology. It's this blend of East and West that allows her to reach a global audience and establish her as one of the one of a kind in the field of mindfulness psychology. Listen to the words, mindfulness psychology. And she's worked with a varied demographic, survivors of tsunami women from economically disadvantaged countries, inner-city youth, suburban families, and corporate leaders. Also, she lectures extensively on mindful living and conscious parenting. She's the author of The Conscious Parent, Transforming Ourselves, Empowering Our Children. And let's say, Shivali, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure to be here.
Did I pronounce your name correctly? I want to get off to a good start.
Sure, it's you did quite well. It's Shivali Sabari, but you can call me Shivali, and that's fine for today.
Well, wonderful. Thank you, Shivali. Shivali, when we look at working with parents, working with children, what is that one thing that you found to be the missing ingredient? And I have to say missing ingredient because that would be something that would be transmitted around the globe. It can't just be in one country. There's got to be some kind of a bonding and attitude between the children and the parent. Where in your experience have you found the disconnect?
The disconnect is in just how we define, look at, and interact within the parenting dynamic. We've got it kind of all wrong. We look at the parent-child dynamic and the journey of parenting as one where the child is the focus and all the raising and the growing up and the onus of responsibility kind of falls on the child's shoulders. And this is where we are completely wrong, because all the raising and the growing up and the responsibility really falls on the parent's shoulders. Once the parents understand that they are as much a recipient of their own parenting dynamic, that they need to grow up as much as their children, that their children, in fact, are growing them up as much as they are growing up their children, the entire dynamic shifts. The paradigm just goes through a transformative, shift, and cultural revolution takes place within the parent-child dynamic. But it really needs to begin with how we look at the parent dynamic, at the parent-child dynamic. And we've been just looking at it in the wrong way. We need to shift the epicenter back to where it needs to be, which is on the parent. And because we parents don't take our own raising, our own growing up seriously, we're missing the key ingredient here. So our children are growing up anchorless, directionless, and devoid of inner connectivity because we parents are not focusing on that within ourselves. You know, we focus on raising the perfect child. We want them to succeed. We want them to be A students. We want them to achieve. But all the time, not modeling any of this in our own lives, in our own being states. So our children grow up addicted to all things external, but really without that inner thriving connectivity, which can only come from the parents' ability to connect within themselves.
Shefali, two things here that you bring up, which are extremely important. The first thing is the parent's ability to bond with that child, and that's really realistically what we're talking about. The parents have been taught from their parents who taught from their parents and on and on. You know, if there could be a class, a course, that if somebody knew they were going to become pregnant or became pregnant, that it was almost mandatory to go to, and it would be parenting 101, and these are the pitfalls that you could fall into if you didn't take these particular steps and move through this path. It's not necessarily what the parents don't know. It's what they don't know that they don't know. And today, especially with this this uncontrollable economy, many parents are concerned about feeding those kids. And at the same time, the problem happens. They get dysfunctional. At that stage of the game, they know the kids are there, but the kids don't exist for them in their minds. They're not being mindful, and all they're doing is worrying about how they're going to take care of the kids while they're not taking care of the kids.
Exactly, exactly. So, but that ability to bond with our children, spirit to spirit, essence to essence, can only take place when we parents are able to step aside from the busyness of life, from the business of life, you know, from the chaos of life, and really connect. And our children are growing up anchorless and directionless, like I said before, addicted to all things external because they haven't been taught and trained to connect with their inner being, with their inner sense of worth and stillness, which will transcend time and hormones and career. You know, we teach our children to be so dependent on things that are transient, actually, that when these transient things are taken away from them, our children are flounder. They don't know how to exist. But all of this grounding, all of this deep sense of anchoring that can take place can only occur within the context of the parent being able to model this themselves. So the disconnect really is within the parent's own state of being, which then gets projected into the parent-child dynamic. The child then picks up on this and begins living their own life in this disconnected way. So that's why I said in the beginning, the paradigm needs to shift where we parents stop focusing on raising that perfect, perfect product of a child, but instead really get back to basics within their own life and begin to live in a deeply connected way within their own being so that this is the grounding, the foundation upon which the child begins to base its sense of self. You know, in our society, the reason it all looks as chaotic as it does is because we all have really lost our inner grounding, our inner capacity to sit with ourselves and to feel our fullness despite the transient nature of life. You know, wealth comes, wealth goes, status can come and go, careers come and go, you know, beauty comes and goes, age comes and goes. It's our ability to hold on to our sense of worth amid the storms of life that really mark us as a resilient being. And this is what we want to teach our children. You know, how can you be resilient despite the storms of life? But this can only come, this sort of deep, purposeful kind of meaningful connection to life can only come when parents have that within their own state of being. And my book, The Conscious Parent, really teaches parents how it is that they can step aside from that craze of life, from that chaos of life, and create that inner bonding that will allow them to then bond with their child.
Shefali, there's an example I've used on the air before, and I think it's going to be very appropriate right now. And I think that the key here is this. Are you sitting by a desk?
Am I sitting by a desk?
Yeah.
Yes, I am.
Oh, okay. Okay. Touch the desk. You touch it. Mm-hmm. Now the desk just came into existence. That's mindfulness. Mm-hmm. Before you touched the desk didn't exist. And that's where I think the key is. The first start with parents and children is touch the child. Physically touch the child. The child now becomes alive. It becomes more than just something they have to work for. You know, you said things come and go. But what doesn't come and go is you don't come and go. You in the general sense of the word. You're here. And the only way that you know that you're here is if you get mindful and present with who you are at the moment. And if you're not present with who you are, you cannot be present with those children around you.
Absolutely. That's so beautifully stated. And really, this is the essence of it all. It's how do we parents enter our state of being, enter that presence-filled awareness, that mindfulness, that deep inner connectivity in the present moment, because our children are waiting. Our children are always ready to connect with us. It's we parents who have become so divorced from that state of stillness and presence and attunement that we're missing these precious moments through which we can have this deep and flourishing relationship with our children. So you're absolutely correct. And this is what we parents need to really train ourselves to do better. Our children come with this sense of attunement. You know, they come with a state of joy. They come connected. But what do we do to them? Because of our state of inner disconnectedness, we disconnect our children from their state of being. And this is a tragedy indeed. So that's why I, you know, in my book and in my teachings really talk about how our children raise us up, because they show us how to come back to this moment and how to be attuned and present and awake to this moment. And our children really are our greatest teachers, if only we would allow them to show us the way.
Behavior, it's based on recognition. Bad behavior gets you attention. Pain gets you attention. Screaming gets you attention. And I really believe it's a shift in the mindset of truly how to get the attention. Because if you're not getting the attention the way that you're talking about it, which is really a very comfortable way to get attention, that's where bonding truly comes from, the connection between the child and the parent. They're going to go out and find it someplace else. That's where you get your gangs, and that's when you get the rest of it. So we search for, there's an innate something within us that says we need identity. And if you want identity, you're going to find it where you're accepted for who and what you are. And if you're not accepted at home, somebody out there is going to accept you. And it could be a life that if you really had the choice, you wouldn't live.
Exactly. You know, as you said, we all have this innate sense of identity, which really is this need to belong, this need to be accepted, this need to be recognized and validated for the essence that we are, the spirit that we are, whatever that may be. We all of us long and are thirsty for unconditional acceptance. And if we, as you said, don't get this in the house, don't get it in the home, and we're not recognized as being contributing, thriving, honorable beings, if this is not how we're treated at home, then definitely we're going to fall astray and look for it in places that may not be desirable and may not be conducive for our ultimate growth. But what choice does a child have? You know, a child that has been thirsty all his life or all her life, parched for a sense of worth, they're going to go look for this sense of worth anywhere they can. And this is the tragedy of it, you know. But if the family recognizes the importance of providing the child with this mirror of validation, of worth, of acceptance, of belonging, and an unconditional sense of, that my child is a contributing being, no matter how they look, no matter how brilliant or not they are, no matter how different they are, but they are contributing, then our child will always hold on to this thriving sense of inner connectivity. You know, I often give the analogy that in the ecological system, everything in nature has a role. Every piece of nature fits together to form this harmonious entity called the universe. So it is in the family. You know, no matter how different our child is from what we may have expected, how not clever or how clever, how not beautiful or beautiful, it doesn't really matter. Every child is worthy of a contribution that is unique. And just like in the ecological system, everything falls into place, so it is in our families. Our children need to feel that they have something to offer, no matter how big or small that offering is.
Well, one of the words you mentioned, the word mirror, and I think mirror is so critical because we have to become models for who they're going to be. And you're going to be a model no matter what you do, good, bad, or indifferent. And you said everything has its own role. No has a role. You know, you could either accept or not accept something based on what comes in. And I think a prime example of how we get so non-mindful, there was a man that I talked to some years back who really made something of himself, eventually became a writer, etc. But in the beginning, he came from a poor family. Rarely did they have dinner together. Dad was a drunk and so on and so forth. He barely made his way through. Thank goodness he had the mother he had who spurred him on to get a college education and go on to where he ended up. But the point was, he said, you know, he would go out and he would fight. Somebody would look at him and the next thing you know, he was with the street gangs and he would get into a fight. And I asked him very simply, who were you hitting? And he looked at me and he paused for a moment and he thought about it. He said, you were hitting your father, weren't you? Model. Unconsciously, we do these things without thinking about it. Mindfulness brings us back to the present. And the present is extremely important because most of us don't live in it.
Mm-hmm. And because we don't live in the present with our children, we're missing all the cues. We're missing the ways that they're signaling to us. You know, our children are always telling us what they need from us. But because we are so preoccupied and so not present that we're missing all the signals. And before you know it, our child has turned 14 and we're calling him or her a nightmare or a monster or a chaotic, you know, destructive force because we simply have missed the boat. Our children are always speaking to us. However, we are just not paying attention. But if we did, if we chose to pay attention to our children, they will allow us to awaken to our own sense of receptivity, of wonder, of awe. And our children will show us that we do have a generative potential. We do have the capacity to take care of them and really honor their spirits if only, you know, we would allow ourselves to. Our children show us also the way back to our own soul, the way back to our own attunement with our own self, because this is what they demand from us. If we were listening to them and if we cared to respond to them, we would be better for it because we would be more awake, more enlightened, more mindful, and more present. So they really show us the way back to our own soul as well.
I think the key is I remember when I was a kid, 300 years ago when I was a kid, and I remember my you know, there were times I was a monster to my mom, but the difference was I was her monster, and we both knew it. And there was a tremendous amount of love there. You know, my mom was my hero. And there is something, we're running out of time, but let me leave with this, and then I want to get your website before we go. And it was Eleanor Roosevelt that said this, and it was extremely important. She said, yesterday's history, tomorrow's a mystery, and today's a gift. That's why we call it the present.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And every moment can be a gift. Okay, do you have a website we can find you at?
Yes, so the book is called The Conscious Parent, and my website is theconsciousparent.com. So people can just go and visit that or go to the publisher's website. It's a wonderful website called namastepublishing.com. So they can Google the book, The Conscious Parent, and they should be taken to both these websites quite quickly.
Wonderful. Shefali, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated every moment of your time, and I'm going to get mindful.
Perfect. Thank you so much for having me.
Wait, I just did it when I was quiet. Hey, thank you so much.
Michael.
Good night.
Good night. Thank you.
You and you alone. Well, that's all. Well, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime. And a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a loving burning light will warm the winter night. Well, that's all. Well, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you. They would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore from now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. We'll be right back.
things I'm doing for you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, yeah, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. I love it when it comes in on me like that. Just makes me want to sing whatever I don't know was coming next. We're going to have some fun. We're going to have some fun now. Chris Miller is with us now. Pre-retirement and living trust expert and national speaker. Chris assists people in developing complete estate packages. Listen to the word pre-retirement. Her practice focuses on helping pre-retirees and seniors reduce their tax liabilities, make safe investments, and protect their savings from probate, nursing home spend down, and seizures of assets to pay medical bills. And let us say, Chris, hi, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
And thank you so much for being here. You know, when it really comes down to it, when somebody decides they're going to retire, that takes some planning, a real planning ahead of time, doesn't it?
It sure does. And you got to start young.
And by the way, I completely agree. But what if somebody isn't young?
Well, you can still start, and that's what people don't get. Most of my clients had waited till they're in their 70s and 80s to start an estate plan, and, you know, it's late, but you can still do it, and there are a lot of things that we go over to help them do that.
Now, by the way, time and again that they've said to people when there was an issue or a subject matter that most people have no concept, no idea about it. We hear about retirement, and we hear about investments, but unless you're in the field, most people just don't know. And we think we should know, but we don't know. And I've said there should be classes, there should be manuals. And your book, you know, Ready for Pre-Retirement, The Essentials You Need to Know So That Your Money Is There When You Need It, is so critically important. There are too many people who need to be held by the hand to move through and say, there's the pitfall, this is an easier way to do it this way, et cetera, et cetera. And I'll bet any amount of money that your phone is probably going off the hook because of the economy today.
Oh, yeah. Because what I do is I provide my clients with information that has been withheld for centuries that attorneys and brokers just don't want to tell everybody about because they don't make as much money. For example, having a living trust. People think, well, if I have a will and I die, it goes to my family. Well, not quite. It's going to take a detour through court and through courts and attorneys and fees. And by the time your family gets it, 5 to 25% is taken out of it. Whereas if you have a living trust, it'll let you leave exactly everything that you have directly from you to your family with no middleman. Now, how come nobody knows about that when it's been around for centuries? It's amazing. Just like the other one is, oh, you got to have your money at risk to make money. There are ways that you can actually make your money and protect it from market loss and the Great Depression. So there's a little. Excuse me.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Well, there's a little bit of a delay, so every once in a while we fall on each other. It's okay. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Well, for example, like in my book, what I did and what I've done is taken all the information that I have learned over 21 years of practice and giving it away because I like to be self-sufficient. So that's what I want to give everybody else. And it gives you a basic outline of the things that you need to prepare. It's like a three-prong foundation. One is if you have assets or kids or children, getting a living trust, powers of attorney for financial health, pour-over wills, living wills, those are all important no matter what age you are. And if you don't have those documents, it's a mess. Okay, that's one prong.
Well, let me hold you up just for a second because I don't want to go by too fast and people miss this thing. I want to go back to probate again for a moment. And most people, they've heard the word, but they have no idea what probate is. And if you die intestate without a will or you don't have a trust, then it's the court that decides where the money goes. And you get a stranger that is appointed and gets paid to handle your estate. And there's where
exactly.
I think, yeah, go ahead.
Exactly. You hit it right on the nose. Probate's courts. Courts take attorneys, and courts and attorneys take money. So what happens is that the family, the loved ones, get caught up in court and the time and the delay and the expense of the simple just leaving what I work my whole life for to my loved ones. And so there is a simple way to set this up ahead of time. That's the living trust.
Yeah, but now, probate, just for a moment, because there's still a couple things about probate. One, it's expensive. There's money that gets spent there that doesn't have to get spent out of the family money. And the time, it takes so much longer to get things settled. There's no privacy. Everything is public record.
Right.
And it's very scary. And it's one of the things that I think everybody in their right mind, if they took a look at it ahead of time, could move by. And let's move into the trust, because I think the trust in and of itself is an extremely important way to protect a family's money.
Yes, and not only in the protection of assets and making sure that your assets go to who you want to, especially because the younger generation, 52% of them get divorced, people do not realize that those assets may go to somebody else's family. So what they've done, you know, if you set this up ahead of time and make sure, this is another thing, make sure that all your beneficiary designations are proper, so you will know, because a lot of times people forget, maybe they just have a 401k and they leave their company and they have their first wife on there, and they forget to change the beneficiary designations, and that can cause problems. So setting up a living trust isn't just creating the document. It's all the things that go into it, making sure all your assets are in the name of the trust. Making sure, like if you have real estate, that is recorded in the name of this trust. Make sure that your power of attorneys are current. People say, well, I have a power of attorney. Well, did you know about the HIPAA law? For example, if you don't have the current power of attorney for health care, you'll be vulnerable. And, for example, the HIPAA law essentially is the right of privacy. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have that clause in your power of attorney, they won't release your medical records. So let's just say you and your family go on a trip and something, God forbid, happens. They won't be able to access those records unless you have that phrase, the HIPAA law, legal language, in that power of attorney. And that's another big mess. So the living trust, you know, the complete trust package would include a living trust, power of attorney for financial, power of attorney for health care, pour over will, living will. It's a whole package, and it isn't just for when you die. It's something that can help you while you're alive right now.
Well, let's talk about something that there's an advantage also. You had mentioned real estate, and a very important thing. Let's say you and I are married, and we'll flip a coin for which one of us passes away, okay? And we bought a house, let's say, 30 years ago. And that house 30 years ago, we bought it for $20,000. Now, in today's market, that house is worth $200,000. Now, in a normal situation, if you sold that house for $200,000, you'd have to pay capital gains on the difference between the basis of the house, which you bought it for, and what you sold it for. On top of that, if there was any depreciation, which lessened the value of the house, you'd have to pay taxes on. So 20, 30 years later, you'd probably have nothing to count against that $200,000. Well, in a trust, there is a step up in basis, and that step up in basis helps the one who survives, because they go around and look at fair market value, and now that $200,000 home could be worth $200,000 in today's market, and if it's sold for $200,000, there's no capital gain on it because that's what the fair market value of the house is. So the surviving spouse gets to take advantage of that.
That is amazing. That is such a brilliant point, and it's so surprising how many even attorneys don't understand that benefit. Yes, the stepped-up tax basis that you get when you have a living trust, and it also works for your investments, too. It includes your stocks or any other investments that you may have. So that is amazing tax savings. Or if you say you went to heaven before I did, which I hope you do, and let's just say I go and I want to sell the house, A year later, I'll only have, they figure this, the stepped up tax basis on the death of the first spouse. So I will only have 1 year of capital gains. So when things kick back into capital gains, that is an amazing amount of savings right there.
Yeah, and there's two kinds of trust. Obviously, there is a revocable and non-revocable trust. Most people move into a revocable trust because it gives them more leeway just in case they decide that this is not what they want. They get into a non-revocable trust, they're stuck. Whatever it is, that's the way it's going to be. And whoever that person is that's handling the trust, that's the one that's picked out to be in charge, is going to stay there and nobody can do anything about it.
Right. And breaking that down a little farther, the regular trust, and then the difference between the revocable and the irrevocable, is a lot of people can use the AB marital trust for estate tax purposes. Now, who knows what that threshold will be, but let's just say it is $1 million and maybe you have $2 million. Some people actually use the AB trust and provisions within that trust that they can avoid estate tax with that kind of trust. So irrevocable trusts are used for estate tax purposes and second marriages. I've had clients that were concerned about the spouse getting married again and then their assets going to another family, where the AB marital trust actually was a perfect vehicle that would protect them from that situation.
See, and that's where I believe strongly in my heart of hearts, people like yourself, professionals like yourself, who deal with it on a daily basis, you have to come to them. And if I say this a million times, I want to say it 5 million times because I truly believe this. There are times when you don't teach, you become a student. There are times when you don't lead, you become a follower. You change hats all the time because there are people who know more about something than you do. And if you allow people to look at things with their eyes, they will see things, well, professionals, they will see things that you don't see, you haven't been trained to see, you haven't been skilled to see, and can change everything in your world completely.
That is so true. It's like putting on another pair of glasses, and after, say, 20 years of being in practice and counseling over 5,000 families, you sure see just about everything. And you don't get that kind of experience out of a textbook. I mean, It really is amazing how each family in each circumstance has so many different variables. It's not like a stock answer. You can just fit it for everybody. And that takes a lot of experience. But my joy is sharing that experience, just like you had your the show that was before me, the person was talking about mindfulness, or
yes,
I call it an estate of mind. So when your estate is set in place, it will give you peace of mind because you won't be worrying about what if this and what if that. And it takes a burden off of you to get all those things set up ahead of time. It's so shocking how many people don't talk to their own spouse about, well, what happens if I had a catastrophic illness? What will we do? Who's going to take care of the kids? What happens if I can't work? You know, all of those variables people don't really even want to think about or don't think about. So it's important.
When you come down to it, it's not think about or don't think about. It's they didn't know to think about it. It's not what you don't
right.
know. You don't know. And it's like this. You put me in your office for a day and you put me in front of your clients, I'm going to get lost. I don't do what you do. So
right.
I would have to come to you and say, okay, here's what it is. Here's what the problem is. And you're going to see it through eyes that have been there, done that, fallen down, got back up again and fixed it. And I get to have the benefit of that.
Right. And we're not just the average worthy estate planner. We love to set people free in the sense of giving them all the information so that when they set up a living trust, they'll know how to keep that trust updated for the rest of their life. They don't have to keep coming back and paying more money. And that's what we've done in the book, is provide a lot of forms, information. We're developing right now with an attorney on some software so that people could actually set some of these documents up themselves on simple estates, and so that the average person can have these documents in place and their estate set up before something happens.
Now, by the way, you're in where, California?
Yes, I am.
What area are you in California?
I'm in Hemet. I'm south of Riverside, about 45 minutes.
Oh, yeah. I know where you are. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, practicing in California, but if I wanted to buy a trust from you, if I wanted to get that, I don't have to be in California, do I?
No. Today's trusts are good in every state except Louisiana. Still under French law. But we've been making trusts all over the country, like I said, for 20 years. And
okay,
they're good
so
everywhere.
So in essence, really, that if I call you, I pick up the book, I do whatever, that you can actually help me and I don't have to actually live in California for you to be able to do that.
Absolutely. We do it all the time. And we're happy to help people. When you do get a trust from us, we set you up lifetime. In other words, if something happens 5 years from now, you can call us. We're happy to share information, and we don't charge you for the call. And this I really like that because, you know, we like to set people free, not buying them up.
You know what? Talk about those attorneys who will charge you for 30 seconds. I got that.
I'm telling you. That's part of what inspired me to do what I'm doing. And I love to share the information and, you know, give presentations. That's why I go all over the country and talk about it.
Sure.
Because it's not talked about.
And the key here is also that I could be 70 years old, I could be 20 years old, and I don't have to take a physical examination to get a trust. It does not matter how old you are to get into this. And then if you're really dealing with that, estate planning. Well, one more question. You just have to think about this as we're talking. What about income coming in from another country? How does the trust protect that?
Well, the income that comes into this country is going to go through your trust because everything that you have is going to be set up in the name of the trust. So, and that it will be all under your Social Security number, so the government will get their tax. And so everything that you have when you set up a trust will be in the name of your trust. You can name it whatever you want, and then you're going to name whoever's going to handle it for you and your powers of attorney that help you while you're still here.
Okay, I've got it loud and clear. Now, one more question, actually, when you're doing the trust. This can all be part of. The trust is not the single most factor to look at. This can all be part of pre-retirement program.
Right. And this is, like I said earlier, this is just one prong of the three prongs that I normally talk to people about. The other one is protection of assets from catastrophic illness and long-term care. One out of two of us after 65 and one out of five under 65 will end up in a convalescent home and our HMOs, our health insurances do not cover this. Medicare does not cover this. And the average cost is $170 to $350 a day. It's wiping more people out than probate. It's outrageous.
What about long-term care?
Well, long-term care is a great thing to set up ahead of time because the younger you get into it, the cheaper it will be, and it will protect you from having to pay all of those things out of pocket, long-term care insurance. You know, one out of 300 people have an auto accident, and by law in California, you have to have auto insurance, and one out of 1,250 have a fire. You know, most people have fire insurance, and one out of two need long-term care. And no, I think it's like, I don't know, it's an outrageous percentage, 2% or something. In the United States has this.
Let's look at this. I think this is important, especially what's going on in politics today. They want to tap into Medicare. They want to tap into Social Security.
Yep.
And if you haven't planned for it and you're over 65, I think it was 65 and 9 months, something like that. When you finally get your Social Security, that's not really enough money to live on. If they tap into Medicare, and if you have some kind of a real problem, and the hospital's not going to say, well, that's okay, we'll skip billing you. It's going to cost a lot of money. And so, what's the alternative? Do you die, or what do you do?
Well, what you do is you set yourself up ahead of time because If you don't, they will make you spend down. For example, in California, if you were single, they'd make you spend down your money to $2,500 before they would even help you. Now,
okay, wait, let's define spend
you,
down. Let me hold you just for a second.
Okay.
Let's define spend down. That means that whatever you have, you've got to sell it.
Right.
To spend it down to reach their limits. Is that what we're talking about?
To qualify for Medi-Cal or Medicaid, as it's called all over the United States, you would have to bring down your assets to that level. Now, they have a five-year look-back period, meaning that if you went and, say, just gave the money to the kids, they would track you down, and that's a misdemeanor. In fact, it used to be a felony, and they put seniors in jail. But now it's a misdemeanor, and if you get in trouble for it, they would disqualify you from the amount of benefits as much as you gave away.
So what are you supposed to do?
But there are ways that, first best way would be if you're in good enough health and you can afford it, is to get yourself some long-term care insurance. That's the best designer way, because you can stay in your own home, and that's the best place to be. When my mom went through 10 years of cancer, and she gave me her medical bills to share to help with people, I'm going to shock you some. Her bill for home care, and it was, guess what, $11,000 a month. Her chemo, she had 5 days of chemo. One round was $90,000. She had 5 days every month. So every month it was $90,000. So her HMO, they had to pay 20%.
You just wrote a check, right?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah. Sure.
My dad is 90, almost 92, still paying the bill off. It's so disgusting. But the point is that these are real things, and they happen to real people, and there are things that you can do to prepare. Now, even people that are ill or too old, there's special kind of annuities that actually protect you from spend down while you are alive.
Chris, let me tell you, we're running out of time, and I'll bring you back. We'll talk about the annuities and the rest of it. But at this stage of the game, we're out of time now. Let me ask you this. Is there a website we can find you at?
There sure is. The website is Ready for Pre-Retirement. That's readyforpretirement.com. readyforpretirement.com. And I wanted to offer, we have a little tip sheet there, 14 estate planning tips. If you guys sign up on this and mention this show, then we're giving discounts on our new ebook that we'll have out pretty soon.
Wonderful. We got to go. Chris, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I sure enjoyed it.
Take care. Good night.
All right. Talk to you later. Talk to you later.
Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. So many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me
Lindsay Parker back with us, managing editor, Yahoo Music, and she's a music expert. She's the managing editor of Yahoo Music and is the author of one of the most popular and widely read American Idol blogs, Reality Rocks. Lindsay's covered and interviewed artists across all genres for nearly two decades now. And Lindsay, welcome to the show. Hello, Lindsay.
Sorry,
how are you? You were only two when you started, right?
Exactly.
I got that. Loud and clear. Hey, how are you?
I'm good.
Good, good, good. Okay, American Idol. Now, what are we looking at? Season 10 so far, what do you see? Through your eyes, how do you see it? Lindsay, do we still have you? Did we lose Lindsay? I hope we didn't lose Lindsay. I'm going to put, well, that's okay. I'm going to put the tinfoil on because the Rays won't get me. And I know the White House is after us from that show we did about 2 weeks ago. Okay, well, Lindsay will come back. I have no idea what happened, but we're going to talk about American Idol. And Lindsay also contributes to music magazines, including Mojo, NME, Guitar One, Revolver, and Guitar. And additionally, she makes regular appearances as a music and TV commentator on VH1 Behind the Music, is a member of MTV, VMA's Voting Academy, and the list goes on. Let me grab something just for a second. That's okay. Now, and by the way, there was something that came across my desk, and it was about a week or so ago, and I looked at this, and I looked at it again, and I thought, that's interesting. It was a story. Surrounded by German troops, 500 American soldiers faced the prospect of imminent death. And although the German threat was significant, a greater threat loomed on the horizon. Believing they were helping the trapped soldiers, the American command ordered a barrage of artillery to break up the German onslaught. Unbeknownst to a higher command, the shells were falling directly on the trapped American troops. Now, by day two, more than half the soldiers had perished. Just about when all hope was lost, the last carrier pigeon, named Cher Ami, was dispatched. Now, German troops quickly responded by filling the sky with bullets. Flying erratically, the injured bird somehow preserved and began to gain altitude. Cher Ami flew 25 miles in 25 minutes, where she was now covered with blood, finally collapsed. And attached to her boot was a canister containing a message. "We are along the road parallel to 276.4. Our own artillery is dropping a barrage directly on us. For heaven's sake, stop it." Cher Ami saved the lives of over 200 Americans that day. Although Cher Ami completed her mission, the bird ended up losing a leg and was blinded in one eye. Now, for the service, our French ally gave Cher Ami the Croix de Gloire Medal of Honor. And less than a year later, Cher Ami succumbed to her injuries and is today on display in Washington, D.C. at the National Museum of American History Smithsonian Institute. Now, this very sad tale of avian determination and endurance raises a very interesting question. The question of how exactly do you train a pigeon to deliver a message across enemy lines? Pigeons are usually devoted to their mates and will fly hundreds of miles without any break if necessary to reconnect with them. In fact, for reasons still unknown, pigeons can make their way home without any knowledge of their location. Now, although they'll use visual cues if available to streamline their flight patterns, they do not require prior knowledge on a flight route to complete their journey. Now, once airborne, pigeons will circle their launch point a few minutes to gain their bearings. Now, afterwards, it's speculated that they rely on a combination of sun orientation, magnetic sensory scent cues, and if available, memory recognition of landmarks to quickly compute their location and optimize their flight plan. Now, this amazing behavior has not gone unappreciated by scientists who today study their incurable mental processing capabilities. Although their brains are small, what they do have and they know uses well in lab tests, pigeons can easily decipher the sex of a human face even within 95% of the images blocked, a feat that would challenge many other human counterparts. In flight, a pigeon's heartbeat can increase to 600 beats a minute. Their amazing endurance, mastery of vertical flight, and cognitive ability and facial recognition, an uncanny knack to find their way home from virtually anywhere, puts them in a class all by themselves. And they may not be the prettiest of birds, but this monogamous and loving species that greets its mate in in what can only be described as an avian kiss is one of the greatest wonders of our world that deserves respect despite the sidewalk presents that the presence that they often leave behind. That was by Robert Haskell. And we've got her back. Lindsay, hi, we lost you.
Yeah, sorry about that. I was on my cell phone. Now I'm on a trusty landline, so sorry about that. Let's try this again.
Okay, now we are looking at season 10. What do you see so far through your eyes?
Well, it's been up and down. You know, of course, going into the season, I expected it to, you know, be a complete misfire because season 9 was such a disappointing season, and now Simon Cowell was gone off to launch The X Factor. But at first, I was very pleasantly surprised. I really thought the new judge chemistry was great, and I loved Steven Tyler. I honestly didn't miss Simon at all. Unfortunately, that was how I felt during the, you know, more edited scripted rounds, you know, the Hollywood Week, the auditions. Now that we're into the live shows, I feel these judges are just being a little bit too nice. And by that, I don't mean they have to be as mean as Simon Cowell was and you know, tell everyone they sound like a cat in a blender and that they, you know, are horrible and worthless and worst thing you've ever heard. I just mean, you know, you got to offer a little constructive criticism and not act like a parent at your kid's ballet recital and just clap and go, oh, that was great. You're so great. Everything's great. Because not everything is great. And these kids, A, are not going to learn if they're not told what they're doing wrong. And B, it makes for, you know, a kind of disappointing season for the viewers if these kids just keep doing the same thing over and over without growing. So I'm a little annoyed by that, and I feel that opinion is shared by a lot of people out there if you see the comments on the blogs and the other blogs out there. As far as the contestants go, I'm pretty happy. There were a few ones that went home earlier than I would have liked, but I think it's a pretty good diverse mix of people. We've got, you know, metal represented. We've got jazz represented. Those are definitely two genres we've never really seen represented before. Country's represented in a big way this year with Scotty and Lauren. And, you know, we've got a little bit of gospel in there. It's interesting, though, none of the people that are remaining in the top six, you know, really represent what's on pop radio right now. The two country kids are not Taylor Swift-style country. They're definitely country, not crossover style. I don't hear a whole lot of, like, that jazzy stuff or that gospel stuff or heavy metal on pop radio. So it's interesting. American Idol doesn't always reflect what actually goes on in the pop marketplace, especially if you look at the past winners of the last couple seasons and you know, how they've fared sales-wise, too.
Now, by the way, taking a look at the past, and obvious Calls isn't there, and as you said, that you didn't really miss him that much. How much of an impact did that man really have on it? I mean, the way he was with everybody, he made himself, you know, tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars over the period of time, being the way he was. One would think in the entertainment industry that you'd want to mimic at least a degree of that, because that's what people came to listen to. That's what they expected.
Well, certainly it has been mimicked on other shows. I've often joked that it seemed like after Cowell, it was like every reality show it was like a quota to meet. You had to have at least one surly, obnoxious British person on the show. Whether it was Gordon Ramsay on, you know, Hell's Kitchen, or even Nigel Lisco, who produces American Idol, who's sort of a more toned-down version of that on So You Think You Can Dance, or, you know, Len on Dancing with the Stars. The list goes on, just kind of like a surly Brit. I have a feeling, in fact, I know from what I've seen of interviews with the producers of Idol, is that they feared that, you know, they didn't just want to cast another guy who fits the Cowell suit. They didn't want to just get an imitator, you know, another nasty person. So they made a conscious effort to get away from that, especially knowing that Simon would be back on Fox and possibly now with Paula Abdul, if he has his way, on his very similar show X Factor, which derailed Pop Idol back in the UK. So, you know, I think they made an effort to kind of reboot the whole show. You know, they got rid of Cara DioGuardi as well. Ellen DeGeneres only lasted a season. You know, the only remaining original judge is Randy. And then they, you know, they put in two very famous faces who, you know, I think have a lot of entertainment value and definitely bring in the viewers. But at the end of the day, there were definitely people out there, more behind-the-scene types, you know, who maybe weren't as famous, but were definitely more qualified to hand out this kind of advice. I mean, we do have to remember Simon Cowell was not famous in America before he was on Idol. So, I mean, that show made him a star. This time I think the show just went out and tried to look for people who were already stars. And, you know, there are pluses and minuses to both to that.
Do you think they'll catch on? Lindsay, do you think they'll catch on? When I say they, we're talking about the judges. Do you think they'll get into, quote unquote, the groove and be able to move through and make it the way Cowles made it, Cowles and Company?
Well, I don't think they'll make it exactly as Cowell made it. They've always made it clear they were never going to go, be that nasty for nastiness' sake. But, yeah, I do think they're sort of catching on. They certainly read their own critiques and their own criticisms. And, excuse me, Jennifer mentioned it sometime last week. She said, everybody wants us to be tougher on you guys. But the point is you're all so good, which was her way of acknowledging that, people have said they need to be tougher. And then it seemed like they sort of got the memo because last week they've been very easy on Scotty McCreery all season. He is a very good country singer, but he never mixes it up, never goes outside of his comfort zone, is very stubborn about that. And while they've never criticized him for that, for the fact that while he's a good singer, all his performances are pretty much the same. And last week was the first time they actually came out and were kind of hard on him. And I'm sure that's because, people have been hard on the judges themselves and have said, like, hey, why are you giving everyone on this show such a free pass? It doesn't make for interesting TV to hear the judges say the same thing over and over again, and that spawns the same type of performances over and over again. But additionally, it may not make for a great recording artist at the end of this, and that, of course, is Jimmy Iovine, the Universal chairman, who is a mentor on the show. That's his concern. He wants to get someone out of this who's ready to sell records.
No, by the way, you said it all. You're ready to sell records. It's entertaining. There's no question, but there's a financial motivation behind it at the same time. So you've got to make you in the general sense of the word. You got to make everybody happy when we're dealing with that. You got an audience to deal with. You got contestants to deal with. You got judges to deal with. You've got the back office to deal with, and that's not an easy thing to do and keep everybody in, quote unquote, controlled and moving in the same direction.
Absolutely not, because often what makes for good TV and what makes for a good recording artist are two completely different things. I mean, although he actually did sell a decent amount of records, so I don't want to shortchange him, but a perfect example would be Taylor Hicks. He made for amazing TV. He was funny. He was goofy. People fell in love with his underdog story. But, once he put out a record, it was not really in keeping with what was going on in pop at the time. No one knew how to market him. And, he only put out one record before 19 dropped him. He's still making music and doing all right, but he certainly didn't become an A-list pop star because he's not the kind of person who would have gone signed otherwise by a major label. You think of the crazy people that bet on American Idol, the Sanjaya types who, they make amazing TV. Everybody wants – it's kind of like if it was Dancing with the Stars. You might want to see the people who are ridiculous, like Kate from Kate Plus 8. But you wouldn't actually ever want to go, pay money to go see them dance professionally. It's like that. Is the person that you found interesting on TV someone you're going to be interested in when you hear them on the radio? And, there are some idols where that's definitely been the case, but obviously there's been quite a few where, no, once the show is over, people seem to lose interest really fast, which must be, a big wake-up call for these people who got record deals out of the show and thought, they were set for life. So it's kind of sad.
Sure. Lindsay, what was the youngster's name? She was very overweight when she was on Idol. Then her mom was murdered. Who was that?
Hudson.
Jennifer Hudson. Yeah, what a great story she is.
Yeah, she actually. It's kind of funny. There's been a bit of revisionist history with her because people often cite her as an example of a shocking elimination. But the night she got eliminated was not that shocking. The reason it was shocking was who she was in the bottom three with, which were two other front runners, LaToya London and Fantasia, who eventually won. And also they were both African-American women. I mean, the three African-American women who were left in the top seven all were in the bottom three that week. And, of course, that raised a lot of eyebrows and, prompted a lot of debates about racism or whatever. But when Jennifer went, she had not been considered a front runner. It was only later, after her break with Dream, from Dream Girls and the Oscars and all the accolades that came from that, that people began to realize what exactly Idol had passed up. How much of her potential hadn't really been tapped into on the show within the limited format of the show. And it's amazing to think how many talented people are on the show who maybe we never hear from again, who actually in the proper environment with the proper chance would have been amazing, because it's amazing to think that someone like Jennifer Hudson only came in seventh. But at the time, I'm sure no one was thinking, "Oh, we'll see her on the Oscars someday." No one was thinking that.
Now, look what the show did for her. I mean, we're running out of time, but look what the show did for her. It caused her to trim down. And, you know, she's gorgeous now, and she's very, very confident in herself and her singing. You can feel it. I was roaring by, the Dancing with the Stars a week or two ago, and she was singing, and I thought, God, what a great story. What an absolutely great story.
Oh, she's a total star. She's exactly what American Idol thrives for, the idea of the rags to riches. Ironically, she actually gained weight for Dreamgirls, and even more ironically, she actually went up against Fantasia Barrino for that part. Obviously, Fantasia didn't get it. And so, yeah, that was sort of, you know, she actually channeled a lot of the anger she felt. If you've seen Dreamgirls, you know what her role was. The anger she felt from Idol, the criticism she got, the fact that she only came in seventh, that, you know, her weight was an issue, all of that hurt and anger she channeled into that Dreamgirls role. That made her an overnight success. Now she's winning Grammys, Oscars. She's a, you know, she's gorgeous. She's slim.
Yeah.
You know, it's a complete Cinderella story. It's a little bit unorthodox. Most of the time people think the Cinderella story happens right when you win or right when you get your record deal. It took her a bit longer. But, yeah, there's no doubt that without Idol, that door wouldn't have been opened. So, I mean, you never know what will come of this show.
Hey, Lindsay Parker, we're just about out of time. Hey, thanks for coming back. I mean, I always enjoy it when you're here. Website, we can find you.
Sure. It's music.yahoo.com. That's Yahoo Music. And my blog is called Reality Rocks.
Wonderful. Hey, Lindsay, thanks. And we'll have you on again.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Take care. Good night.
Night.
I'm thinking everything was all right. Well, I stepped out the tub, I put my feet on the floor. I wrapped the towel around me and I opened the door. And then a splish splash, I jumped back in the bath. Well, how was I to know there was a party going on? There was a splishing and a splashing, reeling with the feeling, moving and a grooving, rocking and a rolling. Bing bang, I saw the whole gang dancing on my living room rug. Flip the flop, they were doing the bop. All the tunes had the dancing bug. There was Lollipopper with a Peggy Sue. Getting Dolly, Miss Molly was even there too. Well, a splish splash.
Welcome back, I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Susan Parker with us. Her new book is Walking in the Deep End. It's a compelling memoir that chronicles the life of a modern American woman as she overcomes a family heritage filled with secrets, painful personal events, and religious hypocrisy. She's been interviewed on numerous radio shows and cable TV shows, works as a diversity and inclusion consultant to workplaces. And let's say, Susan, hi, welcome to the show.
Well, hi, Michael. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Early childhood, most Americans were taught at home and in Sunday school that they should be kind and love your neighbor as yourself. And there were millions of people so eager to criticize and condemn others who have been different beliefs, styles, colors, skins, and the rest of it. Where do you think that contradiction in terms are? You know, what, in one end we hear, be nice and loving, and then the other way we say, well, if they look a little different, if the color's not the same, there's something wrong with them. Where is that confusion coming from?
I hear you. Yeah, I think the contradiction is, you know, we tend to disagree with what's easy to disagree with, right? So if I, for example, am someone who would never cheat on a spouse, I'm going to really rail on people who cheat on their spouses because I think I never do that. Conversely, some people, though, have what's called reaction formation, and actually they're the ones doing that, and they also talk about people poorly who cheat on their spouses. So there's some internal motivations that cause us to do some of the things we do, and I think that shame is a driver in almost all of it. Right? Shame says
sure.
I'm bad. Guilt says I've done something bad, and I think guilt sometimes can be a good motivator. Shame, not at all, and it causes people to act out in ways and take their internalized shame out on others.
I knew people years ago. It was a couple. And they were dealing drugs and they were doing their stuff. And then one of them found God, the other one found God, and they belonged to a particular church. Well, it was kind of interesting because in the church they belonged to, women had to, you couldn't wear pants, you had to wear dresses, and you had to do this, you had to do that. And then somebody left the church, and I was listening to the story about, oh, you know, the devil's got him, Satan's got him. But they moved to a church that was the same denomination, but just a different church, and so on and so forth. There is that point where people lose focus with what God is all about. And go ahead.
I absolutely agree. It's so much easier, you know, I guess maybe for themselves rather than look at themselves and to deal with that person in the mirror, to lose sight of what God is. And God is love. If you have any belief in God, most people believe it somewhere along those lines. All right. But you know, they tend to then think, well, God loves me. I guess I can do, you know, I can do these things and be forgiven. But not so much when other people do it, especially if they're outside what I consider the norm, right? If they don't necessarily look like me or live where I do, or God forbid they're not the same sexual orientation as me, then those kinds of criticisms and focus seem to be on the others versus on dealing with my own self and my own issues. And of course, we've all been guilty of it, right? It's not like you and I, Michael, are sitting here talking about the rest of the world and we've never done. Of course, as humans, we all do this. But how do we minimize that, right, so that we're not constantly doing that and missing the real learning that we can have for ourselves?
No, but the point is, by missing the learning, Susan, we hide. We're taught to blame, and it's their fault, it's his fault, it's her fault, it's everybody else's fault, and this is why I don't get what I get. And I really believe in my heart of hearts, and I'm not a religious guy, I'm more spiritual than religious, mm-hmm. because I've got to a point where I can't fathom that, you know, a God would hate. You know, that's a human emotion. And the moment that I think God hates, then what we have is that we're looking at something that isn't truly the deity.
I totally agree with you. I totally agree with you. And I've even developed something. It's really sort of tongue-in-cheek, but it really is sort of a quiz on, you know, are you a judgmental person? You know, are you intolerant? Are you hypocritical? And I've kind of devised some questions, and I've got a sort of a funny scoring system for it. But, you know, one of the questions is, you know, do you believe that God hates anyone? Right? And if the answer is yes, then you get about 100 points for that. And let me just give you a clue on the scoring system. Getting a high score isn't good, right? So, you know, but that's how people act. You know, when we've seen, you know, those of any of us that have seen things in the media, like recent funerals for people in the military, when Westboro Baptist Church and we love them. Yeah. They make a lot of sense, right? And so when they hold up their signs that, you know, says, you know, God's glad these military folks have died, or God hates fags, and you know, we all know they're crazy. I think probably 98% of the population, if not more, knows they're crazy. But my question on my quiz is how many of you, you know, how many of us have said anything out against that publicly, right? Where are the religious leaders that are not insane, you know, pointing this out? And so you don't really hear that. And so the silence tends to then validate some of this, and it really, you know, when we connect the dots, it ties into at least some of the bullying, some of the self hatred, some of the suicide and homicide that goes on in our society, I think.
A lot of this happens with the fear, and I'll give you another story just as a quick example. The same young woman I was talking about, and then we were talking 35 plus years ago, whatever.
Yeah.
But I remember I was married at the time. And she came over to the house, and I'm half asleep on the couch, and my ex is standing there, and the kid walked in with a bottle of booze, because they had been alcoholics till they found the church also. And she's sitting there with the bottle in front of her, and she's crying and whatever, and my ex is being wonderfully sweet to her and whatever, and I get up in my very sweet self, and okay, what's going on, yada, yada. So what it came down to, which I thought was interesting, Susan, was this, that as long as they were having a problem, they had that joint need to go to the church, and the church would solve it, and they can get closer to God. But the moment that they started feeling good, there wasn't that need for the church and the need to be close to God. So they were starting to find things wrong they could bond with the church and God.
Yeah, that's a really good insight into that. I never really thought of that, but I think you've got a very good point there. And people like to feel like they're in the in crowd, right? And so it's so interesting to me because, you know, we all went through that in high school where, you know, we're in the in crowd, you're not, you know, or you know, some of us were, some of us weren't, whatever. But it's funny when religious people start doing that too, when, especially, you know, from the perspective of my faith as a Christian, where Jesus was all about dealing with the folks on the margins, all about calling in the people that are on the margins of society and bringing them in, not excluding them. And I think what we see very oftentimes in churches right now and in the, some of the televangelists out there is a very much a culture of exclusion, excluding people of Muslim faith.
It's a very interesting point, and this was really good. It's a Sunday morning, and this happened about 2 months ago, and I turned on the television, must have been about 10 o'clock in the morning, and there was an evangelist on, saying basically what he was saying, you know, to find God, you do this, you do that, and when God watches you, and I mean, they were doing everything that these guys do, right? And it was leading you to buy something. And in the back, there was a sign. Susan, I swear, the sign said, miracles are not guaranteed. Do you hear it? They're telling you that they're selling you the book to get the miracles and the rest of it. But in the back, they said miracles aren't guaranteed, so they get sued.
Oh,
it's that that kills the real experience that one has with God.
Yeah, I agree, because I am so happy that I have sort of ignored some of the lies of the so-called religious leaders or so-called religious, because you know, my message, you know, because here's my story, Michael. I realized late in life that I was gay, and it was like becoming an instant minority, right? An instant minority. I'd had the card of white privilege my whole life. I didn't know that I owned the card of heterosexual privilege. But when I lost it, I sure as heck knew what it was like, because people at church who thought I knew a lot and allowed me to teach Bible studies and all that, that all is out the window, right? But here's the good news is that for a while I went through this very, very dark time when I thought about even taking my own life. And I went through this dark time, but I got through it because God is still good. God is still good to me, right? And so they can tell me whatever they want to about how God hates me or I'm condemned. But, you know, I haven't seen that from God. And so I feel very fortunate.
I really believe in my heart of hearts, how does a sexual act, and not one that's forced on someone. So let's make the divide there. Okay, how could that stop you from getting to heaven if you truly, absolutely love someone and you're loved back? People search for that constantly, and if you find it, then you have found it. If you want to be condemned for it, I think what actually goes on are people are frightened to death of what they don't understand.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And what they think that could possibly be in themselves or somebody in their family, and that scares the heck out of them. But
you know where the big battle about gay marriage came from? It wasn't about gay marriage. If they would have just let the significant other have the benefits that somebody who was heterosexual have, then it would have all been settled. But they didn't do it. So what was the other way to do it? You go for marriage. And there's where the problem started. That didn't come from the gay community. That came from the people who wouldn't let them have what they wanted. Had they said okay to that, none of these conflicts and battles would be going on right now.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Because frankly, I don't think we should care what it's called. It's just like to have equal rights and benefits. That's all.
Yeah.
So call it something else if you don't like marriage. That's how I feel. You know, if it's offensive to somebody to call it marriage, gray, so what? You know, but to deny people, you know, the basic rights and make us pay the same taxes doesn't feel fair, doesn't feel good.
No question about it. It's all learned. If you can unlearn, you can relearn. Yeah, I mean, I got that loud and clear. But see, that's where the key is. It's allowing yourself to be able to move through and come to the table values neutral. Without the gotchas and who's right and who's wrong, because it's not about right or wrong. It's about creating from a place of nothing.
That's exactly right. I love that philosophy. I totally buy into that now, Michael. But you can imagine as a former evangelical, I'm not a former Christian, but I'm a former capital E evangelical. That was hard for me to get, you know, because we had these phrases where we would say, the Bible said it, I believe it, that settles it. And no one told us that there was various versions of the Bible, right? People were interpreting things through the different lenses. And if that's not indoctrination, I don't know what is. If that's not somewhat of a mind control thing when you're a little kid and someone tells you that. So, you know, therefore we've got this epidemic of evangelicals. So, you know, evangelicals have a higher divorce rate than others within the population, slightly higher, like a 1% higher, but it's still higher. Evangelicals, there's a lot of gay people in the evangelical world, but they're not allowed to be. And so they hate themselves and they hang themselves and they kill themselves, right? There are, you know, people in the evangelical community who have mental illnesses, but they feel like, well, I can't get help because God should be fixing, God's fixing this. And if he's not, I clearly must be a bigger sinner than I know. All these things are sort of like voodoo religion. It's sort of silly. It's not only silly, but it's damaging. And I guess that's part of why I wanted to share my story, not to criticize or not to war with people who don't agree with me, but to try to have some dialogue around issues that are important and that are affecting society at large.
I think we're going to have a very interesting case come about. Did you happen to catch that that scene? I remember my sister came to me and she gave it to me in one way until the reality of it came out. Did you happen to see those two African-American girls beating up on the white girl?
I did not see that.
Okay, but this is going to get even interesting. So she came in and she said, well, you know, gee, what would happen if there were two white girls beating up on a black girl? And she got off on the tangent. And so let it go. And then the next day they redid it again. Well, the story is deeper than the two black girls beating up on the white girl, because the white girl is not a white girl. The white girl is a transsexual. And
oh, right.
the reason they were beating up on her was because she came on to one of them's boyfriend. Now, getting beat up is not that's not the way to handle it. But now they're going to start to push hate crime. And I think that this is going to be very interesting to see what happens when hate isn't against black or white or brown and white or whatever it is back and forth, when it's going to be two African-American girls and one transsexual male to female. This could be a very interesting court case, because where are you going to go?
Yeah, it is an interesting court case. And it should be just in the, you know, we should just look at this. These are human beings. We're all flawed. It doesn't matter what box we check on our demographics. We're all flawed, and bad behavior and illegal behavior ought to be treated the same. So, I am a diversity inclusion consultant, but that's part of diversity inclusion is recognizing that and, you know, recognizing we're all part of this human family, and we're all flawed and have different aspects that are flawed. But, you know, the rule of law ought to be the rule of law. It ought to be what's in charge here. And so, you know, it'll be interesting because people will try to pull in different aspects of demographics when,
how are you going to say race? But the two girls that happen to be African American, they're pushing hate crime now. And so how are you?
So I think it's a hate crime. So unless I'm misunderstanding, and I forgive me, but I think this is that scene at McDonald's. I think it's a hate crime because, you know, people really recoil at transgendered folks. And I've seen it even in the gay community where they have a hard time dealing with transgendered folks. And I, you know, I never understood it. It's not something that appeal, you know, that applies to me in any way. But I've met several transgendered folks over the years, and it's really interesting to hear them talk and to share their pain, this real pain that they feel, feeling like, I mean, can you imagine? You feel like you're the opposite gender of what your body is. And people tend to really talk about not understanding it and causing fear. They get a lot of grief. I've never met a transgender person, and I've probably met a dozen, who hasn't been beaten up quite a bit.
Susan, the girl got beat up because she was transgender. It wasn't because she was white. It was because she was transgender, and the boyfriend came on to her.
Yeah. So they're going to use a hate crime because it's a gay hate crime, right?
Well, they beat her. I mean, it was on television. You could watch the whole thing. It's not hearsay.
Yeah.
Oh, no, they hated her. I mean, there was no question about it, and it was specific. So it's going to be very interesting to see how that thing turns out. Susan Parker, we're just about out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
I do. It's called www.walkinginthedeepend.com, and I'm also available for speaking engagements. I really help people get, you know, really get beyond some of their issues and some of their problems, and I'm really involved with the power of this moment, you know, helping people connect to that and get through their trauma and not be defined by it.
Wonderful. Hey, Susan Parker, go get them.
Thanks so much. Thanks, Michael. Have a great evening. Bye.
Good night. Good night. Hey, thanks for listening. And as a matter of fact, if you like what you hear, go tell all your friends about it. That's the way we grow. That's what you call networking. I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.